This episode of The Ready Room is brought to you by the Star Trek Starships Collection from Eagle Moss, the ultimate collection officially authorized by CBS Studios, featuring vessels from 50 years of Star Trek. Each is expertly sculpted, hand-painted, and comes with an authoritative collector's magazine. Start your collection today with the USS Enterprise 1701D for only $4.95 with free shipping. For details and to order, visit st-starships.com/readyroom. And by audible.com, offering more than 150,000 titles for smartphone, tablet, and desktop. If you love podcasts, you're going to love audible.com and the ability to read your favorite books, plus those you've been wanting to get to, while on the go or at work. To get a free audiobook of your choice, visit audibletrial.com/trekfm. And also by Enterprise in Space. Find out how you can help science and education and become a virtual crew member aboard the NSS Enterprise Orbiter. Visit enterpriseinspace.org for more details.
Hi, this is Michael Dorn, Lieutenant Commander Worf from Next Generation and Deep Space Nine, and you're listening to Trek FM.
Welcome to The Ready Room, show number 206, Flamenco Stunt Dancer. I'm Christopher Jones, and with me this week is Aaron Harvey. We'll be talking about some Star Trek news, including the Star Trek Beyond press conference held in LA, spoiler-free first impressions of the film, and reports that a fourth installment is on the way. Then in the feature, we're joined by Andy Vanderkolk and Mike Morrison to discuss the original series episode, Plato's Stepchildren. So let's step into the Ready Room. Hello, Aaron. It's great to have you here with me on the Ready Room as we head into Beyond Week. Right after this episode drops later this week, everyone will be able to do what you have already done, and that's see Star Trek Beyond.
Yes, it is Beyond Week, and Beyond is stretching beyond this week into next week, and it's been kind of a roller coaster ride so far. It's been quite fun.
Well, for me, seeing Star Trek Beyond is beyond the number of days that I can count, because it's October 22nd. For me in
you need
Japan,
just although, to get on an airplane and fly over here.
Well, I'm pretty sure I will see it earlier at Paramount's offices in Tokyo, which is how I saw Into Darkness, but I don't know when, because the press screenings for Into Darkness that Paramount did were still about 6 weeks after the U.S. premiere of Into Darkness. So I don't know what they're going to do for Beyond, because Beyond is 2 months later than Into Darkness in terms of release date. So
well, maybe it's really because messy. It's getting good early buzz, maybe they'll move that all up like they did that to us. So who knows?
Maybe. That would be nice, because it is getting good reviews. And if they think people will be eager to see it, then perhaps. I do hope so.
Because I don't think I'm going to be able to keep spoilers for till October with you. That's going to be very difficult.
It's going to be hard for me, you know. So the next episode of The Ready Room after this one, the feature will be Star Trek Beyond. Matthew Rushing, executive producer here on the network and my co-host on The Orb, he will be running the feature without me. So I'll be in news, I'll be in the closing, I will not be in the feature. We did the same thing for Into Darkness. Tristan Riddell from To the Journey ran that feature for us. So that's what we're going to be doing next episode of The Ready Room.
And I'll be on that episode.
Yeah, for me,
as well.
Like being in the Babel Conference is going to be very difficult, right? Because everyone's going to be posting about Beyond, and
we will try to keep it within one spoiler thread, and we'll see. I'm sure that the admins will be good about making sure that things aren't.
You know, what's interesting for me with this is that my position on the last two J.J. Abrams films was that I don't care enough about it to even worry about spoiler. I'm being honest, especially Into Darkness. I'm like, I don't care. Give me spoilers, because I'm not invested in this. I don't care about this version of Star Trek. I'll go see it, but
it's not like I was with First Contact, for example, where I was trying everything in my power to avoid any kind of spoiler. But after seeing the little clips that they've put out from Beyond, after hearing from you and other people who have seen it, that it's really good and that you really loved it, now I'm really eager to see it and I don't want it to be spoiled for me.
Yeah, I was very much the same way. I was not invested in it. In fact, I was actually seriously considering not going to the press screening because mm-hmm. I am also going to the fan event, the world premiere in San Diego, which is not really a world premiere anymore.
Right. We were talking about that the other day. Like, what does world premiere mean, right?
Exactly. Do I really want to go see this? Because if I don't like it, I don't want to drive, 2.5 hours to go see it again. And yeah. I am beyond excited to go see it again so I can find all of the other little, Easter eggs and little name checks that people have dropped in that I may have missed. Mm-hmm. And I know I've missed two of them already because I've heard them from other people that saw the movie with them. So I'm excited to go back and see that.
Well, what we're going to talk about in news today before we get into the feature, we're going to be joined by Mike Morrison and Andy Vanderkolk to talk about Plato's stepchildren from the original series. Before that, we're going to talk about your experience seeing Star Trek Beyond. This is going to be spoiler-free,
yes.
So don't worry. You can listen through. We're not going to give away anything about what happens in the movie. But Aaron, you went over on July 13th to Century City, and you saw Star Trek Beyond together with John Champion and others that we know mm-hmm. from the network and friends of the network. And then on the 14th at the Four Seasons Hotel in Beverly Hills, you attended a press conference, event. And Simon Pegg was there, and Berta Orsi was there, and many other actors. And I guess JJ was there as well, right?
Yeah. Actually going to be there, but yeah, he showed up. Mm. That was pretty cool.
So tell us about the experience. Why don't we start with the 14th with mm-hmm. the presser?
Okay.
And then afterwards, you can share some of your spoiler-free impressions of the movie.
Sure. So I was sort of doing double duty. I was going for Trek FM, because I'm also going to be on the next Ready Room, like we talked about, and for Trek Movie. So I was there sort of just seeing what everybody was saying. And like I said, at first I didn't even know what the buzz was going to be like, because if it hadn't been good, that press conference could have been kind of either a sleeping session or something, or just like, marking time. But mm-hmm. the actors who we joked about the world premiere not being the world premiere, because they have been in Australia and then in the UK and now they're back.
Well, it screened first in Australia.
Yes.
And then in the UK, almost a week, I think, before
yes.
the one you went to in the US, right?
And then I think like just 2 days before the press screening, it was in the UK. Or something to that. It was pretty close, because everybody, while extremely charming and nice, are very tired. You could tell
they
just would like a nap. So, it was really interesting conversation. We learned from Carl Urban that a sharp-eyed fan basically tipped him off to the fact that the women's outfits didn't have rank on them because they didn't have sleeves. And so he was the one who went to the costumer and said, hey, can we do something about this? Because, Zoe should have rank. And so that was kind of cool to hear that he was one of the people who brought that to the filmmaker's attention. We got to hear about, there really wasn't a lot left on the cutting room floor, because they were pretty judicious about cutting stuff before it got to the shooting point. So they really seem to have gone through the script quite a bit.
I guess they have to on the compressed timeline that they were.
Yeah. And I think that actually really worked out well for them. I think that, I almost wonder, I've done that in my own job. I'm a graphic designer, where sometimes the limited amount of time that you have actually forces you to make some quick decisions and not hem and haw or something and turn out something that looks much better. So I think that might have actually helped this. I know there was a quote last fall from Simon Pegg about how he came in, and one of the things that they were concerned about is that the movie was too Star Trek-y. And after seeing the film and then listening to their conversations at the press conference, you can kind of get that the gist was that it wasn't, oh no, it is actually, quote unquote, good from a fan standpoint. It was that it might have actually been structured a little bit too much like an episode, and there might have been too much a little too much of the delving into techno babble that we didn't really need to be in, and just some of the things that they sliced, while interesting and actually having known that, makes the rest of the movie better because they had that information in the back of their heads, so that makes the scenes themselves play out better, didn't need to be seen. So I think trimming some of that stuff out is maybe what they were talking about, and it really seemed to work well. We talked, you know, J.J. Abrams was there, and you can kind of see the evolution of him as someone connected with Star Trek compared to, you know, 2009, he was basically the guy who never watched Star Trek and, like, whatever. It was sort of a, I don't care. And then into Star Trek Into Darkness, it was, I'm kind of debuting my skills and showing off, and this is how I want to make my way into Star Wars. And now, after he had been in Star Wars, it really, he understands fandom, I think, better, which is weird given that he has worked on things that are, you know, pretty much in the pop culture and had fandom.
But not to the extent of Star Trek and Star Wars.
Correct. Though. Yes. Yeah. And I think that him interacting with the people from Star Wars is like, oh, this is how Star Trek feels about how fans feel about Star Trek. That I get that. And so while he himself may not feel that way, he got the right people involved who were. And I think, you know, bringing Simon Pegg in as a writer really worked well. Simon Pegg has played characters that have made jokes about Star Trek that, you know, and about he said, I have made jokes about odd number Star Treks. And guess what? I have now directed an odd number star written an odd number Star
or
Trek.
Written one, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Written. Sorry. So he's like, you know, fingers crossed that this somehow breaks that, or it's the reverse in the Kelvin universe.
Oh, maybe that's it. Yes. Yeah. Yes. Yes.
So there was a, you know, a lot of good discussion. There was, in this movie, a spoiler-free, you know, as you can tell from the commercials, they kind of have, people are paired off. So the actors themselves got to kind of hang out and interact with people they might not necessarily have interacted with on the bridge. So there was a lot of really interesting discussion about, like, what was it like for Zoe Saldana and John Cho to work together? And they were kind of, you know, on the planet, well, they were all on the planet, but they were together, and they asked, you know, Zoe, if does Uhura like being on the planet, or does Uhura like being in the ship? And she's like, no, Uhura likes the ship. The ship is clean. The ship doesn't have dust flying around from helicopters trying to get shots. Like, so I think she was, you know, as that seemed like it might have been a fairly grueling day, or not day, but a grueling set, just for being around with all of the, because you don't hear all of the other things that actually is physically going on when it's happening, which is kind of interesting to then put your mindset into that when you see them. And so, but everybody really seemed to, there was a camaraderie there that was really nice to see, that I really felt that when I've seen other Star Trek people from the prime timeline interact with each other, there's that same family effect. So I really think, you know, and Justin Lin, his movies are all about family, even though they're about, you know, fast cars.
Yeah.
So I think he really fostered that not only in the storytelling, but also in the actors. And of course, there was the sad moment of having to talk about Anton, which was difficult.
Yeah. Did they do any kind of tribute to him, or how did they address that?
Well, in the press
situation
conference,
where they're trying to celebrate the film, but obviously this tragedy has happened.
Right. It was Simon Pegg. But for him, he said it's not real yet. He knows it's happened. He's dealing with it, but it just has not sunk in. And that the best thing that he can think is that from now on, Anton will always be on that screen. He will always be the fresh-faced, you know, Pavel Chekhov, who's eager and ready to do anything that needs to be done. So, and he gets some great moments, and it's just, yeah, there's, and without spoiling anything, I can't say certain things, but it's just, there's just some very nice moments. And the whole cast and crew are just, you know, they apparently, he was about set to direct his own film. And in his spare time, he was translating a Russian book of an obscure sort of, like, I guess, a philosopher. And had decided that he was going to do this. And then there was a movie that was either related to the book or it was sort of along the same themes. And he invited everybody to go see it. And they're like, oh, yeah, we'd love to go see that. And, you know, and I think it was Carl Urban who says, I believe I saw it. I'm not quite sure if I was awake for it. So there was all these lovely moments of just, you know, talking about him and how he would just show up on set even when it wasn't his day to record because he wanted to watch everybody having fun. So yeah. it was really lovely to hear that. And I think that they really honored him by not being too maudlin about it. I mean, it's noted in the film, but it's not, you know, it's hard to talk about it too, because it's the same, you know, it's so fresh. It's just, it's,
yeah, exactly.
You know, give me a year and I'll have a different perspective on it. So,
yeah. Well, I mean, I know how they feel, because as anyone who has listened to this show for years knows, you know, I lost my father a few years ago
and right.
had to let that sink in. And I'm not sure that it fully has, but
I don't think it ever does. Yeah. I think it's, yeah,
it's been 4 years now, but well, let's talk about the day before
mm-hmm.
at the theater. You went and you saw the screening of Star Trek Beyond. So again, no spoilers, but
right.
What's your overall impression? How do you feel about this movie?
My overall impression was I left and I was just in a good mood. It was, you know, without any details, it is a big screen TOS episode. It's just, it has that feel. It has some core themes that fit with that, which I can't talk about because that would spoil something. mm-hmm. But there are... Watching the original series, there's bits and pieces pulled out, but it doesn't feel like Into Darkness, where it felt like they went into Memory Alpha and went, okay, there's this piece on the shelf and I'll pull that out and I'll pull it all in a blender. And Star Trek science fiction, right? So it should look like, what's that Star Wars thing? That looks like science fiction. We'll just make it look like that. Yeah. It didn't feel like that.
Let's take the most iconic thing we can find and just remake it.
Yeah,
and just
exactly.
twist it around a little bit. No one will notice.
No.
Yes. So it's not like that at all.
It really felt like this is what I like about parallel universe stories, where it's like you see what it was originally and then what they do with it is interesting, as opposed to they just did it differently to be different. Mm-hmm. So I that's what I really appreciated about that. So while I was not invested in the universe before, I kind of am now, because, you know, and this is going back to the press conference real quick. It ended with Scott Mantz, who was the host, asking, you know, where does Star Trek future films go from here? Have you thought about an episode 4? You know, that was the joke towards episode 4 being, you know, Star Wars related for JJ. And he said, you know, it's hopefully something that we are figurative minutes away from talking about. The answer is 100% yes, and it's incredibly exciting. So if you parse those words, yes, they've talked about a Star Trek 4, which of course they would have. And then later there's been some information that it's written, it's ready to go, and it's just like, I don't think any of that's true.
No, I don't believe any of that.
So I will believe that when I hear it from Paramount.
So the story is going around now that they're going to do a Star Trek 4. Of course, they signed the actors to a fourth film previously,
correct.
So they already had that in place. My feeling going into this, when they were still just trying to figure out how to get Beyond put together,
mm-hmm.
when they tossed out that original story and then they gave it to Simon Pegg to write, was that the third one would be the last one, and that signing the actors to a fourth was just sort of a way of giving the actors a little mm-hmm. something extra in a negotiation. But they want to make money.
Right.
I always talk about this on the show. They want to make money.
And there's nothing wrong with that either. Doesn't always seem like a horrible thing. You know,
that's what they're in the business of, is making movies to make money, right?
Yes, exactly.
If this movie makes a lot of money, then yes, they'll probably go on and make a fourth. The feeling that I had was that this movie was going to bomb at the box office because Into Darkness fans weren't happy with it. And then there was so much turmoil in getting this one put together. But now that we're seeing that it seems that Lynn and Peg have pulled off a miracle and gotten it all done in the compressed timeline, put together something that Star Trek fans are now seeing in early screenings and are saying, this is great. It's getting good reviews in various media outlets.
You know, and there are parts in the movie which will be a bridge too far for some people. You know, it's and once you have seen this, you and I will have a discussion about a particular thing that it refers to that's not in the Star Trek franchise in another franchise unrelated. So I and that you probably know about. So I'm curious.
I'll just tell you right now, yeah. I'm not okay with the whole Spock Ensign Leffler relationship thing. I mean, that was just too far for me. Leffler's for me, not for Spock. So I'm just kidding. Once I see the movie, we'll talk about whatever it is that you're talking about. But my point is that I think this is going to do well. I think it is going to have a big box office. And therefore, I do think they probably will make a fourth film. And so ultimately, how do you feel now about the idea that the Abramsverse or the Kelvin timeline is going to continue?
Yep.
And does the fact that we're also going to have prime timeline television at the same time make you kind of more comfortable with it?
I'm now excited that there might be a fourth film. And what's interesting is that people used to say, well, it's a trilogy. It can't be a fourth film. You do not have to see Star Trek Into Darkness to watch this movie
at all. It's not a trilogy at all.
No, it never was, but I've heard that more than, like, it's normal, it seems like, so.
Well, just yesterday, I saw some major news outlet label this as, it's the sequel to Star Trek Into Darkness. I said, it's not a sequel. A sequel is a continuation of the story.
Right.
This is another independent story set in the same universe.
If it's a sequel to anything, it's 2009. You can literally pull out Star Trek Into Darkness and there might be some emotional content that you're like, okay, I had to pull that out of what happened before, but it is mostly from 2009. So we've had people ask, what if I'm bringing people who haven't seen Star Trek or any of the other Star Trek films, what do I need to tell them? It's like, well, they do need to know something about 2009. They do not need to know anything about Star Trek Into Darkness.
So you're saying that Star Trek Into Darkness is the Galactica 1980 of the Star Trek Kelvin timeline franchise?
It is the Phantom Menace Galactica 1980. Well, I guess you have to know Phantom Menace, but it's like it is the Galactica 1980 of.
That's why that scene when the Cylon walks past the warp core and then sparks fly out of his chest and he falls over, I thought that was a little bit too much as well. Have you seen Galactica 1980? You've watched it.
Yes. As a child, I would go outside afterwards and get my bicycle and pretend it was a hover motorcycle or flying motorcycle. So, yes.
Do you remember this episode where the Cylon is in somebody's just regular house and they're having a party and it goes in the kitchen and it walks past the microwave and the sparks start flying out of it and it falls over?
It was Halloween. That was the way that they were able to get around and walk.
The costume party episode. Yes,
It had, what's his name? The radio DJ, Howlin', the Wolfman Jack. It had Wolfman Jack and Elvira, I believe,
in it. Oh, Wolfman Jack. Oh, yeah.
Yes. Yeah. So, yeah, no, that was crazy. Yeah, the Space Scouts, we could do a whole Galactica 1980 podcast. That might be the logical progression from Star Trek, the animated series, into Galactica 1980.
I think maybe we need to do this at some point. So, okay.
I think April 1st, if you remember this, let's see what happens.
Okay. Good idea. Let me ask you one more quick thing here. I'm looking at an article on Trek Corps, and they're talking about a fourth movie. J.J. Abrams is saying that they will not replace Chekhov. They won't recast Chekhov, which I think is the right thing to do. I think they should acknowledge that he has passed away. They should acknowledge something in the fourth film, but certainly don't recast him. But they're also asking, who would you replace him with? And as the host of our animated series show, would you like to see A-Rex replace Chekhov on the Enterprise? So in live action, obviously he would be, well, not obviously. I started to say obviously he would be CGI, but they could just do really good makeup and have
Well, you know, after seeing this movie, there are some aliens in it who actually I do know the person who did the alien design, which is kind of cool, that I saw that and I immediately said, oh, wow, they could do Eric's and it would not look cheesy. It would not. I mean, I'm not quite sure how much you could have him as a like a character where you spend a lot of time, you know, like as much as you would as with a human, completely human person, but maybe you could, you know,
well,
check
he could
off,
get as much screen time as Travis did on Enterprise.
Yeah, right? I was going to say, it, depending on what the story is, Chekhov might not have had that much screen time anyway.
Yeah, most episodes he's just there. He and Sulu both are just like sitting there. At
and
the
that
consoles,
is kind of,
right?
Yeah, that, yeah. So, yes, I think I have a pre-you seeing the movie answer and a post-you seeing the movie answer. So right now, yes, I think Eric's would be really cool. And of course, as a person who hosts an animated series podcast, I at least want to see him. I would love to see him. I'd love to see Emress. I think that would be fun because we've seen Acacian already in both 2009 and Into Darkness. So,
yeah, and also in Star Trek V.
Yes. So that character, that species has already been represented. So I would love to see Eric's. And I think, you know, if you watch Voyager, when you have the species 8472, they kind of have a similar body structure with the three legs and the
arms. They're both like tripod.
Yeah. So I think characters. It totally could be done now really awesomely.
Yeah. I guess we also probably saw Cations in the council scenes in The Voyage Home. As well,
yes, we
briefly,
did. Yeah, you're right.
Like in the crowd. So,
yep. Yeah. Who knows where else we saw them when they just were the makeup was done so badly that we didn't notice.
Right. Maybe Spot was supposed to be one. And they said, we can't pull off the makeup. Just get us a real cat.
If we had the reverse of the de-evolution episode, it'd be the evolution episode. They could have, we could have had all the people would turn into, you know, space lizards, and then the cat would turn into a Cation. If it was that episode, but in reverse.
All right. Well, to close this out, just final verdict for anyone who's been on the fence, for anyone who's been, JJ sucks, I'm not going to see this movie, your recommendation is?
I would say give it a chance. I mean, if you're really that against the timeline and you don't like the characters and you don't, you know, I was like, it's going to be hard to convince you, but go see it, give it a chance. They've, the characters all seem to have grown up. The actors feel like they're inhabiting the roles a lot better. It's fun. There's some things that might be too fun for some people. Like I use that as a, I know this sounds strange, but it's just like, it could be just a bit pushed over, but no film is perfect. And there are things in here that's like, okay, I wouldn't have done that, but I didn't leave going, I really wish I had my 2 hours back. So I really enjoyed it. There's callbacks to virtually every series. So there's fun things to even go back and see it a second time to pick up on things you've missed. You know, numbers have significance. Everything is, you know, it's like it's like 47 for prime people. You have certain numbers that'll mean something to you.
Sounds good. Well, I'm looking forward to seeing it eventually. Thanks
we have
for
to
sharing
fix that
your
for
experience
you.
At the presser and at the screening with us. All right. Well, before we go into the feature, I'd like to thank our sponsor for this episode, Eagle Moss, and the official Star Trek Starships collection. These are the ships that are officially authorized by CBS Studios, and they are an extensive collection that features the most significant vessels from across all 5 Star Trek series, they say, but I'm going to correct them and say all 6 Star Trek series, plus each of the movies from Star Trek The Motion Picture through to the new Star Trek Beyond. Now, why did I correct Eagle Moss in information that they gave me? Well, it's because, Aaron, I happen to know that you have a ship from the animated series from the Eagle Moss collection right there in your studio.
Yes, it is the Antares, which is a cargo vessel. And they might say 5 because in the remastered version of the original series, they have taken that design from the animated series and put it into live action, which is pretty
that's
awesome.
True. That's true.
So, you know, I'll cut them some slack on that. So that's, you know, the Time magazine cover that doesn't have 6 series, that I don't cut slack for. They also omitted Scotty and Chekhov. So that needs some help. But no, this, I love this ship. The fact that they've actually taken these unusual vessels that you wouldn't, you know, this is not your first tier vessel. This is not your second tier vessel. Even this might be your third you know, pass if you were going through and picking what ship to create. But I the detail that they put into it is amazing. And they don't feel like they're lightweight pieces of, you know, prefab plastic. They've got some heft to them.
Each model feels really nice when you hold it because each is cast in a specially formulated metallic resin and hand-painted with reference to the actual CG models used in production. And when they have them, they use photos of the original studio models as references as well. Each ship also comes with a collector's magazine featuring behind-the-scenes info, original design sketches, and a breakdown of technology on board. And you get two new ships every month if you subscribe. You can start your collection today and get the 1701D for just $4.95 with free shipping. And then two ships will be delivered directly to your door every month. Now, you can cancel your subscription anytime if you want, but I don't think you're going to want to when you see these ships because they are so beautiful. And there are so many of them now. There are so many different ones to choose from.
You may just need to get a new house. That's the big thing.
Like, maybe that's what you need. Yeah. You need a new house. You need a bigger room for the whole collection because there are just so, so many. If you look at the show page for this episode, you'll see an image there of the entire collection. Or just go to st-starships.com/readyroom. That's a special URL just for us, st-starships.com/readyroom. They have a wonderful image on their website of, it's actually probably not all of the ships at this point because they've made even more since the time that they took this group photo, but you can mouse over it and you can zoom in and you can really see the detail on these ships and they're really, really beautiful. So check it out, support Trek FM, support the Ready Room and all the shows on the network and start your collection today with the USS Enterprise 1701D for just $4.95 with free shipping. Again, be sure to use the URL st-starships.com/readyroom. And we really thank Eagle Moss and the official Star Trek Starships collection for supporting the show.
Take care, young ladies, and value your wine. Be watchful of young men in their velvet prime. Deeply they'll swallow from your finest kegs. Then swiftly be gone, leaving bitter dregs. Ah, bitter dregs. With smiling words and tender touch, man offers little and asks for so much. He loves in the breathless excitement of night, then leaves with your treasure in cold morning light. Ah, in cold morning light.
Uncontrolled power will turn even saints into savages. This is what Captain Kirk explains to Parman, the sadistic leader of the Platonians in Plato's Stepchildren. Despite being amongst TOS's campiest episodes, this story of power unchecked and the struggle to overcome injustice has been an inspiration to many since it first aired in 1968. And today we're going to discuss this classic episode. To help us do that, we're joined by one of the co-hosts of Women at Warp, also known as First Time Trek on Twitter, Andy Vanderkolk. Andy, welcome back.
Thanks so much for having me.
Great to have you on. It's been quite a long time since you've been on the Ready Room, but we've had some of our most entertaining original series discussions with you around.
Well, thanks. That's very nice.
Also joining us, and still sleeping on the cot just across the room, apparently, from Maida Trex, it's Mike Morrison. Mike, welcome back.
Thank you, Chris. It's a pleasure. That cot is actually quite comfortable.
Yeah, I almost didn't say welcome back because, well, you never leave, so here you are. All right, before we get into the discussion, as we always do here on the Ready Room, here is a synopsis, quick overview of the episode, in case you haven't seen it in a while. The Enterprise receives a distress call from a nearby planet, and when they arrive, they are greeted by a short, cheerful man named Alexander. They soon learn that he is essentially a servant for the people who need help, a group of powerful aliens who have based their society on the teachings of Plato. After arriving on this planet more than 2,000 years earlier, they developed psychokinetic powers that stem from a chemical in the native fruit. They ask Dr. McCoy for assistance because the leader, Parman, has cut himself and it has become infected. So McCoy helps him, he heals Parman, and afterwards the Plutonians give Kirk, Spock, and McCoy some random gifts and ask the doctor to come live with them. When he refuses, Parman and his wife, Phalana, use their powers to torture the crew, which now includes Uhura and Nurse Chapel, who they beamed down against their will from the ship. And they have plans to kill them all when forcing them to dance, kiss, and whip each other is no longer fun. Along the way, Kirk and Spock learn a great deal about the Plutonians from Alexander, who is tired of being abused by them and is taken with the kindness of Kirk. They find a way to give themselves psychokinetic power, stop Parman's plan, and prevent Alexander from killing him. They tell Parman to be nice to people from now on, and they have spared his life so that he can. Then they beam back up to the ship with Alexander and fly away. So that's the basic rundown, a very quick summary of what happens in this episode, Plato Stepchildren. Now, let's go on and start off with our initial thoughts. Andy, what are your first thoughts on Plato Stepchildren?
Well, the first time I saw it, when I first time tracked it, I was kind of inundated with tweets telling me how much I was going to hate the episode and, oh no, the worst episode ever. You're going to hate it. And then I was watching it. I was like, you guys, I kind of like this episode. Kind of. I mean, it's definitely an interesting episode, and I think that the themes are really interesting. So even though I think it's got some flaws, I definitely did not hate it as much as everyone wanted me to / expected me to hate it. So it was cool. I always like to mix things up. Like, I also thought The Inner Light was overrated, which also blew their minds. So, you know, every once in a while, I like to zig when people want me to zag.
How many tweets did you get telling you that this or that original series episode was the worst episode ever, or you're going to hate this episode?
I always leave like 5 or so minutes in between when I tweet that I'm going to be tweeting and what episode it's going to be. And I usually get, you know, 5 to 10 at least tweets telling me what I'm going to think about the episode, whether it's I'm going to love it or I'm going to hate it or whatever people think. And it always makes me laugh. People have very strong feelings about what my feelings are going to be. So.
Well, they know better than you, Andy, about what you like or don't.
Yeah,
like.
For the movies, the motion picture was split right down the middle. I had so many, that is easily the most divisive. Like, I had so many people being like, you'll love it. And then so many people being like, worst movie ever. And then, you know, I liked it. So they're not always right.
Well, Mike, what are your first thoughts here on Plato's Stepchildren?
My feelings are pretty clear. I'm pretty certain how I feel about it. I'm a huge original series fan. And what's not to like about this particular episode? It's got a lot of really standout material as far as some points that we'll discuss later on in the podcast, I'm sure. The first interracial kiss on American television. But besides that, this episode is actually based on Plato's dialogue from the Paradox of the Philosopher King from the Republic. And so there's a lot of really rich philosophical material in here as well. In fact, if I can engage in a little shameless self-promotion, Zachary and I actually took this on Metatrex 15, The Philanthropist Negus. We talked about this particular episode of the original series and what they got right and what they got wrong from Plato's dialogue on the Philosopher King. So really, really rich episode. A lot of really great stuff to dive into. A lot of things to wrap your mind around. There's just nothing to dislike as far as my feelings are concerned.
So Mike, if we're playing right or wrong here, fruit that gives you superpowers, did they get that right or did they get that wrong from the original?
Well, I mean, it was either fruit or a radioactive spider. So, I think they got it right.
Very good. All right, Aaron, how about you?
I'm finding as time has gone on that I have to have sort of two sets of reactions, because I saw most of the original series with my grandfather between the age of like 2 and 5. So a lot of my early impressions are based on, can a 2 or 5-year-old basically sit through an episode and find something they like in it? Okay, Kirk is running around like a horse, which is kind of fun, I guess. But beyond that, it was like there was just, it's an empty set. It's a lot of running around, a lot of thoughtful looks and words that I didn't understand as a kid. But as an adult, I've found that I like the position that they put the characters in, and it's sort of pitting their natures against themselves almost. And just I think that's pretty fascinating. So I enjoy it much more. And still, I think on occasion, I will confuse it with Who Mourns for Adonais and wonder why it's the wrong episode.
Well, my memories of this episode are, I guess, somewhat similar to yours. Not 2 to 5, but I started watching Star Trek when I was around 5. So still at that very young age, I was seeing this episode as well as others, and just have the memories of watching it from a kid's perspective, as you were saying. Then later on, when I started collecting the original series on VHS tape, I had this, and I used to always pop one in at night to watch at bedtime before I had to go to school the next day. And then I didn't watch this episode for many, many years, and I watched it a few times recently. I had forgotten just how over the top the acting is. I've seen a number of discussions recently about William Shatner and people who say he overacts, but people also not really remembering the difference in style at the time that these episodes were shot compared to acting now. And the fact that, as you were saying, Aaron, it's an empty set. You know, the only thing that some of these episodes, especially third season episodes, have to drive them is the dialogue and is the expression and the acting. You know, they have to carry everything because there's not much around them. But this one is still quite entertaining. But underlying this is a really good message. When you hear Kirk say that where he comes from, you know, size, shape, and color don't matter. One thing that attracted me to Star Trek when I was younger was the idea that we were going to get to that place. And then for a long time, it felt like we were heading there. And then today I watched this and I realize how those words that he's speaking are still so far away from where we are now. And that gives some added, you know, weight to the message, even if you have to sort of dig through Kirk running around like a horse with Alexander on his back, you know, to get to that part of the message. So those are sort of my initial thoughts on it anyway. I did want to share real quick on that topic an episode that I would encourage everyone to go listen to. It's a show that I used to do. I don't do it anymore. I might do it in the future, but that's MatterStream, which is a show about science and social issues and such. Actually, the second podcast on the network. The Ready Room is the oldest podcast, and MatterStream was the second. But on MatterStream 11, I interviewed Dan Madsen. And many of you listening will know Dan as the founder of the official Star Trek fan club. He was also the publisher of Star Trek Communicator magazine for all of those years that it was around. And of course, Larry Nemechek used to be the editor. And in that episode, Dan talked about how Plato's Stepchildren was such an important episode for him and moved him toward Star Trek, because many of you know Dan is shorter in stature. He has some issues. And the fact that Alexander was presented as being just as valid as everyone else, and the way that Kirk and Spock treat Alexander, was important and showed that this was a show that had a different message from what you were getting from the rest of society at the time. And I mean, even today, you still get that some as well. But anyway, that's MatterStream 11. It's called Dan Madsen, A Lifelong Journey with Star Trek. So I just encourage everyone to listen to that as a supplemental to what we're going to talk about today.
That line from Alexander basically, or that line to Alexander is basically to me the mission statement of the show. It's like kind of
Star Trek, right?
Of Star Trek in general, mm-hmm. of getting to that place, of getting to that world where that is a true statement that you can say with confidence. And it's the reason that I love Star Trek so much.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And same for me. And I think same for so many Star Trek fans. Absolutely. Well, let's move on with the conversation, and enough of me rambling. So let's get you guys talking some here. Let's stay on the topic of size, shape, and color, talking about Alexander, talking about the first kiss, which Mike mentioned, which has become a bigger topic than it once was in terms of, is it the first interracial kiss or not? But Aaron, what are your thoughts on Alexander in this episode and the role that he plays compared to the Platonians, which we'll figure out what we're going to call them along the way?
Well, growing up, I had a congenital heart defect, so I still have a congenital heart defect, but it's different now. But I had stunted growth, not to that extent. And so there was a lot of things I could see, and like, I'm not the same as other kids, as my abilities. So I think I definitely kind of felt a kinship with that character in that sense. And like Andy was saying, just that the whole mission statement, that idea that in the future that that wouldn't be an issue was something that was one of the things that made Star Trek so appealing to me. So while this episode itself may not be my favorite in the it wouldn't be one that I would just pop on and like, oh, I'm going to watch Star Trek, so I want to watch this. The message itself is really important, and it's something that I really connected with him. And I really also felt that for what he's gone through, he's still a really strong character. As far as his own self, is like he hasn't given up, which I think really kind of amazing, given that it's, what, 2,000 years or something that it's been since they visited Earth and they've ended up having this extended life.
Alexander, for me, is the highlight and the best part of this episode. The actor is incredible.
And he's great.
It's just a pleasure to watch him, especially in the climactic moment where he rejects the power and he rejects abusing that power, which to me, the themes of this episode are all about power. Who has it, how you use it, how you abuse it, what can go wrong if you have too much of it, stuff like that. And it's really lovely to have this person who has been oppressed for his whole life finally getting a chance to, you know, stand up and getting the chance to oppress others and rejecting it. And that to me is just so beautiful. And he sells it so perfectly. And I can watch that speech, that pain and that anger and that, like, no, I reject this, is to me the best part of this episode, hands down.
Alexander by far has the best dialogue in this episode, as opposed to McCoy, who it seems like all he ever says in the entire episode is stop it, stop it. But Alexander's dialogue was really strong. And what we saw through the course of the episode is what Alexander lacked in stature, he far surpassed it in his character. You know, he said to Kirk, you think that's what I want, to become one of them, to become my own enemy. As Andy said, he rejects that opportunity that he has to gain that power. And just the character and it's just the character that he demonstrates, I think, shows that, again, what he lacks in stature, he just all that much more in the character of the man that he is. I do have to say, though, I think they missed an opportunity in JJ Trek. I've often thought that Keenzer should have actually been Alexander when Kirk says, hey, Kirk to Enterprise, Mr. Scotty said, prepare to beam us up. I have a little surprise for you. I think they should have carried that over into JJ Trek, into the Kelvin verse, and Keenzer should have been Alexander.
That's interesting. I've never, ever thought of that before.
Because it just seemed like he was taking a friend to Scotty, you know, and I just, in my head canon, those two hung out after that. He, you know, he put on a red shirt and hung out in the engine room, and, you know, Scotty and he had a little banter going back and forth. And, you know, that's season four, you know.
So are you suggesting that the only thing Alexander would eat is a little bean?
Just a wee bean.
A wee bean. Yes.
Yeah.
So that's between the original series and the animated series. Somewhere in there is this window.
Somewhere in the middle there, Aaron.
He transferred when Eric's came in and Chekhov left. They went off together.
Oh. For me, Alexander also is the best part of this episode. And Michael Dunn is the actor who played him. And from the very moment that they beam down when he comes out, you're like, wow, this is sort of an unusual presentation of a character for the original series, but he's doing it so well. And then when he takes them off to meet the Plutonians, you can tell that, I don't know, there's something about, you talked about how he's remained strong even though he's been abused for thousands of years. But yeah, there is this strength you get from the very beginning, the first time you hear him talking. There's a strength inside him that for him to put up with all the crap that he has to put up with all the time and to still be internally, it seems, so happy and confident with himself is amazing. And it's part of the message that pushes through this and sort of the internal strength that it takes to fight against this kind of oppression. It's a wonderful part of the story.
It would be really interesting to see what happened to that character like 5 or 10 years later, because when you don't have to deal with that sometimes, then you just sort of like just let go, and just then you have that, that's when you have your crisis moment after you don't have to be strong anymore. So it'd be kind of curious to see what that would be like. I don't know. I don't think we ever see him again in any kind of novelization or anything.
That is one thing about Star Trek. And luckily, the novels do pick up many of these characters, but we are always seeing these moments where they take somebody up to the ship and they remove them from a bad situation like this and then never hear from them again. So it would be nice to know what happens to those people.
Yeah.
Well, they use his expressions a lot in the scenes where Kirk is being abused by Parman's power. And he's the reason those scenes really sell. It's his reaction, the wincing, the looking away. He sells those scenes. I mean, they're somewhat cheesy. Kirk slapping himself back and forth as they, you know, cut to commercial. But what sold that was Alexander. And again, I think there's a sincerity of his character that I almost felt like he didn't mind so much that he was being abused. What injured him was watching Parman abuse others.
Yeah, because I'm sure that he, not only has he experienced this abuse himself, but he has seen them do this to other travelers, I would imagine. Mm-hmm. So he knows what's coming up and he's frustrated by it and he has no ability to change it. So he has to just sit and tolerate.
With a lesser actor, this would be one of those, like, you know, Spock's brain level of what people think is awful. We had the conversation, Spock's brain is not as bad as we think it is, but that perception of it just, you know, you have Kirk slapping himself back and forth, which is, you know, a meme at this point. If that was met with a lesser actor with the expressions that he had and not just that empathy that you feel through him, it'd be like, wow, this is super cheesy. And I'm not, you wouldn't get that emotional attachment. And you really do through this actor.
Yeah, if you didn't have the cutscenes going back to him, absolutely.
Yeah, that's true. What's interesting is that you do get some of that cheesiness, and it's not so much the people getting, you know, basically the sadistic torture. It's the look on, what is it, Barbara Babcock? The smirk. She's just like, you know, it's like, I just look at that and that made my skin crawl. It was just like you could just this bizarre pleasure she was getting from just utterly humiliating these people. And it's just, ugh.
Her smirks give you that feeling compared to the other two Plutonians who are so arrogant. They're Heraclitus and Dionid, I think are their names. Mm-hmm. And they're kind of over the top, you know, arrogant, smug. They are playing the chess and they're sitting there watching the whole whip scene and the kissing scene as well. They were sort of caricatures, whereas with Philana, it really felt like she was getting this sadistic pleasure out of what was going on, right?
Yeah.
It almost gives you the feeling like perhaps the first visitors there were tortured probably very little, killed very fast. And it's almost like they have to draw out the torture and it's got to be more elaborate and more humiliating in order for them to get pleasure. And she kind of sells that.
Yeah.
It almost feels more Roman than Greek in some ways. I thought it was.
In that sense, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I have to say, too, that I think this is an episode where writing and acting come together to do something really, really great. And what I appreciate as I watched this, and I've seen it numerous times, is to watch Alexander respond throughout the course of the episode and see his character grow. It's as though he's drawing courage from Kirk and Spock and McCoy's resistance, that he's drawing courage from that. And you really get to see him grow as a character in the course of these 52 minutes.
Well, he tells them that I didn't know people like you even existed.
Yes. And the fact that they went the extra mile at the end of the episode and Kirk makes good on his promise to take him out of there, I just thought that was a nice touch at the end. Because they could have just left that open and you're left to assume.
Like that he would overthrow Parman in the end.
Yeah. You know, did Kirk take him or didn't he? But they actually wrote it in and showed that Kirk made good on that promise. I thought that was a nice touch.
I'm just glad they didn't do the horse thing again to beam up. That would have been too much. So
I know that we need, you know, for them to like, oh, I've never seen a person who existed like this before. So it would be nice some sort of in the Star Trek universe that the Federation wasn't the only nice guys, that maybe we'd come across another group of people who were like-minded and had banded together, like just with a different, you know, group of people or something. It's just every once in a while, it'd be nice to come across as a little more balanced as far as other species and their apparently empathy.
But Aaron, it's always us or them, right? We're always good and they're always bad. We're always right and they're always wrong.
Yes, and I understand it was the 60s and it was a little bit more, you know, cut and dry, but maybe in the new series there'll be something that's more like that. We'll come across a confederation as opposed to a federation. I don't know.
Maybe that's the new cruise.
Yeah, right.
New worlds. So maybe so.
New global, multi-global, yes, organizations.
New federations.
That would be interesting.
All right. Well, let's talk about the kiss a little bit. The kiss has gone from, traditionally, we're told, the first interracial kiss on American television. And then over time, more and more information comes out, and they say, well, no, this show did this, this show did this, and it wasn't actually the first interracial kiss. And now if you look at Memory Alpha, it says, to be more precise, it was the first kiss between a fictional white male and a fictional black female to premiere on American network television, as Kirk kissed an Asian actress, France Nguyen, in a previously recorded but later aired episode, A Line of Troyes. And then they go on to talk about other television shows. They talk about Nancy Sinatra and Sammy Davis Jr. greeting each other with a kiss on Moving In with Nancy in 1967, which I did not see, and so I have no idea what the actual kiss was. I don't know if they're referring to the traditional peck on the cheek greeting kiss like they do in Europe, or I don't think that Nancy Sinatra and Sammy Davis Jr. met at mid-stage and started making out. I don't think that happened. So I don't know. It feels like we're trying to, you know, mince words and get overly specific in details to the point of trying to diminish the significance of this kiss. But whether it was the first or not, it played a very important part, I think, in American television history and taking us one step further towards accepting the fact that it shouldn't matter which race two people are if they kiss, if they care about one another.
I think that this is an important moment and definitely a step forward. I have always found it interesting slash disturbing that they made this big leap and then made the kiss not consensual.
That's a good point. Mm-hmm.
But I as you said, like, it's not to diminish the moment. It's still a big step. It was still a big deal. It was still a big risk to take. Mm-hmm. And it still was towards a goal of showing that this is okay. It just has, because bear in mind that I watched it, you know, almost 50 years later, knowing that it was this big deal, but not actually having any idea what the actual story around the kiss was. And mm-hmm. I was all pumped up to see it. And then I was like, okay, so they were forced to kiss. And that to me is interesting and a little bit sad. But I actually think that that kiss scene is very indicative of the themes in this episode, which is to say, again, power. You know, they do not have the power to initiate or reject these kisses. They're being forced together for entertainment. So it's a very interesting look at what consent means and, you know, how you can take something beautiful and make it horrible by virtue of making it without power. And so in that way, I still think it's really interesting. I would also point out that directly afterwards, they, you know, whip a black woman. That's also not great. But overall, it's still important. And I'm still glad they did it. And I don't know. Like, I think that we needed someone to take this step. And I'm glad that Star Trek did it.
Well, talking about it being consensual, not consensual, one thing that's interesting here is you have Chapel kissing Spock, you have Uhura kissing Kirk. Now, Chapel has wanted to kiss Spock for a long time, but here she doesn't want to because they're being forced, right? Like she would like to kiss Spock, but not under these circumstances, which is, of course, understandable. Then you have Kirk and Uhura has not been walking around wanting to kiss Kirk, but Uhura explains how Kirk has helped ease her fears as the captain, and they have a strong respect for each other, and they're being forced to kiss. I don't exactly know how to explain what I feel from it, but it's just like the contrast between the two pairings. When they're both being forced to kiss and knowing sort of the back history of the relationship between the two characters is sort of an interesting contrast.
Yeah. I've also really thought that it's very interesting to me that Uhura is basically comforting Kirk in that moment.
Yeah.
Which I think is quite lovely in a lot of ways, but also very interesting that, like, she is also being forced to do this against her will. But while she's doing that, she's also, like, reminding Kirk that he is a person that she has always trusted and that right. She still trusts him. And I don't, like, the whole scene is, like, you can read it a lot of different ways. And I think there are a lot of both positive and negative ways that you can take it. And in that way, I think it's very nuanced and interesting.
Yeah, I think the contrast between the two couplings is really interesting. Chapel does say to Spock, "For so long, I've wanted to be close to you. Now all I want to do is crawl away and die." And so she's humiliated because she feels exposed. And here is Uhura to some degree exposed. But Andy, just like you said, she's comforting Kirk. She's saying, "Hey, I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid." And so I you almost had to make this a forced thing, because I don't think the relationship between the two of them was such that they would have ever done this consensually. So from a writing standpoint, I think it had to be something forced or non-consensual in order to make it happen. But I do appreciate the fact that they take that original, that initial thought at the beginning of the episode, when he says to Alexander, "Where I come from, size, shape, and color makes no difference." And they take it, you know, beyond to this point and put this on the television screen in, you know, the late 1960s, and they kind of bridge that barrier. I think it's a great thing.
Something kind of interesting that's, like, we're looking ahead at Saturday Morning Trek, the animated series, of some of the things we're going to be talking about. And there is an episode with Harry Mudd where he's selling basically a love potion. And yes, I understand it's the animated series, so it's not going to have the exact same depth, but it's very interesting that Christine Chapel seems to have no problem forcing Spock to love her, because that's what she's trying to do with this potion, where she was just like, oh, I don't want to be forced to do it the other way around. So that's something we were going to bring up, that it was like, oh, there's kind of an interesting, you know, thematic throwback to Plato's Stepchildren in that one scene where it's just the...
Maybe if more of the items on the set in this episode had been pink, then she would have been more comfortable with the idea.
Yeah, I mean, you basically just described why I think that's the least, like, the worst episode of the animated series, Aaron.
She literally falls into his lap. I mean,
it's bueno. Bad.
No.
Do you think that they had some awkward moments as they passed one another in the corridors on Enterprise in the days following this, where they're kind of covering their face and walking by, and just those awkward moments, you know, they're on the bridge together and Kirk turns around and asks Suhura to hail the ship and their eyes kind of meet. And then they look away real fast. Just these weird, awkward moments because, you know, they know what happened.
Could be, but that's an interesting question in Star Trek, because the characters so often find themselves forced to do things under the influence of an alien or a substance or something that you wonder, their training combined with their experience, do those things allow them to compartmentalize these experiences and separate themselves from them?
Yeah, but in The Next Generation, when Data demonstrates that he's fully functional and skilled in multiple techniques, they have this awkward moment, he and Tasha Yar, at the end of that episode, where she's embarrassed and she was under the influence. He was under the influence. And so there's that awkward moment where she stops him and says, nothing, that did not happen. So right. it just makes you wonder.
Well, and how much of the detail of what happened actually makes it into, like, Starfleet reports? Oh, you know, it's just like,
reading Tasha's log on that one?
Well, not even, Tasha, but just in this episode, even. It's like, how much of, like, it's like, you know, we went down, we were forced to do humiliating things. Like, did they go into that level of detail of, like, oh, you know, Chapel had to kiss Spock, I had to kiss Uhura? You know,
Well, remember, Aaron, on the original series, they are writing those logs while they're doing these things.
Okay.
You know, we're like in Gamesters of Triskelion, Kirk is pinned to the ground with a knife at his throat, and he's actually recording a captain's log at that moment.
Captain's log, Stardate.
Yeah. It's kind of interesting. You're talking about the interracial kiss and then being forced to do things. In Britain, I think it was like the 90s before this was able to be shown, not because of the interracial kiss, but because of the sadistic nature of what they were doing.
Yeah, they considered the torture way more of a problem.
Well, they also had a couple kissing like 10 years before, so.
Yeah.
But imagine if this episode were made today. So we see Kirk using the whip, but we don't actually see it happening, right? Like, they don't show a whip hitting Uhura or anything like that. If this episode were made today on modern television, these scenes would be stuff that, I mean, I personally wouldn't even bother watching. Because that's how it would be played. Now, maybe on Star Trek, they wouldn't do that. But on general television, the way shows are made these days.
A Game of Thrones or something like that.
Yeah. Yeah. If they were portraying torture on a television show. So it shows, again, how it's sort of like the way we're talking about how for Falana, they have to keep ramping it up over time to get the same effect. That's how our television has become as well.
Yeah, good point.
Yeah.
Let's go back to something you said earlier, Andy, where you were watching this for the first time and you weren't exactly sure how you were supposed to feel or react, because you've got a very serious message, but you have a portrayal of actions going on that are almost comical at times because they're so over the top. And when they first come walking into the room, I think it's the first time they're under the control of Parman and they're being all dragged to this chamber. It reminded me of the Ministry of Sillywalks from Monty Python. It's this over-exaggerated motion. But at the time, this type of acting was more common. Certainly the facial expressions, the exaggerations that Kirk generally does. And in this episode, it's taken to an extreme. And then you also have not only the facial expressions, but you have more general emotions happening here. Does this, I guess you kind of answered this question already a little bit, so I'll throw it over to Mike. Does this pull you out of the episode too much when you watch this now?
No, not really, because in my mind as I'm watching this, I recognize that they are under the influence of Parman's control. So to some degree, I don't expect them to, I don't expect their motions and movements to be natural. I think this is actually one case where Shatner's overacting really works. I think it's appropriate.
My favorite moment is when his tongue comes out and bends to the side. It's just completely over the top.
I don't know. I really
and then he
enjoyed
falls to the floor. Yes.
I really enjoyed watching Alexander ride in Michael
Boris.
That,
to me
that
is
was
horrifying.
Did you?
It is. That was it tough. Is. It's just disturbing, but quite entertaining, I have to say.
I don't know. For me, that was pretty rough. And I mean, the fact that he got on him and rode him like a horse for a moment is one thing, but it kept going on and it kept going on. And then finally Parman looks to McCoy and says, "How can you let this go on?" And I'm thinking, what do you mean? You're the jerk that's doing this.
And it seems, at one point I didn't know how to feel, like if it's like, okay, I get it, they're doing this so we feel bad, but it's like, should we actually also feel bad for the actor being forced to do this, even though it's supposed to be something horrible? But it's like, should it even have gone that far to have done that to begin with?
Yeah.
You know, is there something else that they could have done that is less demeaning to him?
Well, but if it were less demeaning to him, would it diminish the impact of the story?
Well, yeah, I don't, that's why I'm a little torn of if it's actually demeaning to the actor or if it was demeaning enough in the story or if there could have been a different way to do it and get the same idea across.
I think it goes on too long and it's repeated too often. So The biggest flaw I find with this episode is the pacing. We spend a lot of time on this when I feel like one scene would have done. And We could have used that time and maybe more exploring more of the themes, because I mean, they spend a significant amount of time doing the same basic thing, which is I'm going to make Kirk and Spock do really demeaning things in order to torture McCoy. And then I'm going to do it again. And then I'm going to do it again, you know? And so it starts to drag, I think. As for like telling you, like, look at me, what you're making me do. That's classic abuser. Abusers do that all the time. You know, why are you making me hit you? Like, why are you making me angry? Mm-hmm. They put the fault with the victim rather
the
than themselves.
On the victim, yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. So it's a way to justify their own behavior to themselves and to their victim, and also train their victim that they deserve it and that it's their fault. So that tracks really well for me. I think that that's actually pretty precise language and dialogue that gives me a very clear idea of who Parman is, which is an abuser.
It occurs to me, though, that the repeated nature of the abuse in this episode really just layer after layer after layer builds to that point at the end of the episode where you're really wondering, okay, is Alexander going to kill him? Is Alexander, you know, going to take his life? Is Kirk going to be able to withstand this? So you have these layers of abuse. So I really don't have a problem with the pacing or the amount of time they spend just adding layer after layer of abuse. I think it wouldn't have been as climactic at the end had there not been multiple layers, these multiple scenes where we're just taking the abuse to the next level, to the next level, to the next level. Because in our universe, oftentimes abusers start out with something simple like verbal abuse, and then it becomes physical abuse, and then it becomes sexual abuse or something, you know, something really sadistic in our minds. And for that matter, going back to the point that Chris made, had this been filmed today, those scenes maybe with the whip, there would have been contact shown and maybe some blood, some gore. So you really couldn't do that in the 1960s. So, you know, they just add these multiple layers of abuse, I think, so that you can get that payoff at the end when Alexander doesn't give in to his baser nature and Kirk, Spock, and McCoy are able to endure this and rise above it. And even the point that Kirk makes to Parman at the end when Parman says, you know, I did all this stuff to you and you're not going to kill me. And Kirk says to him, you know, killing even for the purpose of revenge is still murder to us. And we're just not going to do that.
I think Alexander is interesting here because you make a good point in building up to that. And where this highlights the difference between Star Trek and other storytelling, even at the time, is that Alexander doesn't kill Parman at the end, because outside of Star Trek, I think that he would have stabbed Parman at the end. But Alexander, it's not exactly true that Alexander doesn't give in to his baser nature. Kirk stops him from doing it.
Sure.
If Kirk had not been there, and therefore if the Star Trek message, if Gene Roddenberry's position on this had not been there, I think Alexander still would have killed Parman.
Mm-hmm.
And so this is Star Trek trying to teach us over time to take a more measured approach to things.
Yeah. But would that scene have made as much sense, perhaps, had there not been these multiple layers of abuse? If we would have reduced that to one scene.
Sure. That's what we're, I think you make a good point that you have to build up to that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
What they could have done is actually shown more of what they did with Uhura and Chapel beforehand. If you wanted to have the same level, but break up the like who it was done to a little bit more, maybe we could have seen them being forced off the ship or something like that, where you're just breaking up the physical location of the action. And that might just have been a pacing or a price thing, a cost thing, or
Because related to that, I wanted to roll back around to Andy, what you said earlier. My first reaction is that they have to fill 52 minutes and they have almost no money to do it with in the third season. And so I think a lot of times we get this pacing problem because they just have to fill the time. And what can we do? We can put everybody in a room and let's just do this. But then, as you say, Aaron, showing some stuff on the ship, that could work. Andy, what would you do, though, like in terms of exploring the issue, maybe through dialogue or something? What would you like to have seen them write instead of scene after scene of kind of repetitive torture?
One thing that I would have done, which I know they wouldn't have done because they had this whole thing of we want to get to the planet right away, is I would have spent some time on the ship. So one thing that we start to get in TNG that we don't have in TOS is a more modern way of storytelling in which you have an opening that's supposedly unrelated to the rest of the episode, but is related to the themes. Mm-hmm. That's what I would have done, but that's definitely a modern way of telling the story, and definitely not something that the network especially really didn't like. That they wanted to go straight to the action, and I get that, but to me that means that you have less action overall because you're having to, it does feel to me like it starts to feel like filler. So for me, I would have added a scene or two at the beginning on the ship, maybe reestablishing some of the relationships in an interesting way and kind of exploring some of the power themes, and then go to the planet. But I mean, that's, as I said, not likely that they would have done that.
Yeah. I think related to TNG, in the middle of this episode, there would have been a scene where they gain access to the computers and they look up the records of the Plutonians and what they were like beforehand.
Or, you know, a moon falls out of the sky.
Oh, yes, a moon falls out of the sky and they have to stop Parman. They have to take control of the situation. And then they also have to increase their powers to a level that allows them to push the moon back into orbit.
Yeah, or the Romulans are there.
Or
you know what? You know what actually what it is? It's there's a diseased planet that they have to get medicine to, and they're all dying, and if they don't get there on time.
Yeah.
Well.
And it turns out that Alexander is a diplomat and he's the only one who can negotiate a treaty between two warring factions in order to secure the shipment of medication. Yes.
But I mean, with TNG, you saw this with, say, you would have a cold open on the holodeck where they would do some Shakespeare or, right. you know, they would have a poker game. And, you know, they did that well and they did that badly, but they did that often, you know, and it does add a different layer of grounding it in our characters. So I prefer that structure to the TOS structure of this is our episode. You know, like they just like drive into it right away. So that's just a personal preference, though.
Now, I prefer that style as well. One other thing I wanted to point out that I had never noticed before, and maybe my eyes are deceiving me, but I was watching Plato's Stepchildren on Blu-ray today. And in the scene where Kirk is on the floor and they make Spock dance around him, I'm pretty certain they're using a stunt dancer. I don't think that's Leonard Nimoy when they show the pull-away shots. It looks like someone else several times. And then when they go really close in, it's Leonard Nimoy again.
Yeah, I agree. I'm really certain. Although I've got to say, there's just nothing cooler than a Vulcan flamenco dance.
But I'm just thinking, I can understand with certain kinds of stunts that you need a stunt actor. But dancing? I mean, could Leonard Nimoy not do the flamenco dance around Kirk's head?
Probably not.
Is there some kind of union regulation that said, like, he cannot flamenco dance unless you pay him 2x rate or something?
Nimoy said, listen, I will write bitter dregs, but I've got 2 left feet, so you're going to have to get a stunt double in here for that.
Maybe that is it. Maybe that is it. Well, let's talk about that song, which, of course, everyone calls Bitter Dregs because it has that in the lines. The song's actually called Maiden Wine, which was written by Leonard Nimoy.
Mm-hmm.
Does this song, I mean, like, do you have this in your iTunes? Do you play this once a day?
I love that whole scene. I love Spock singing A++. Make Spock sing more, please, and thank you. Really, really great.
I'm right there with you, Andy.
I love Leonard Nimoy and I love Spock. And I just think that it's just so lovely to see him serenade everybody. And I wish he serenaded me every day.
As I understand it, Chris, they told him the day before they filmed this scene that he was going to do a little ditty, and they kind of gave him some structure and basically told him to come up with something. So he literally wrote this the day before, and it's fantastic. I mean, it almost seems as something that would have come right out of that era in our own universe for real, not something that he probably wrote on a napkin the day before they filmed it.
It is an interesting song, and it's a nice callback to Charlie X when we see Spock singing or playing the harp. I guess Uhura's
playing
singing,
the harp.
But he's playing the harp in Charlie X, yeah. And we don't see him doing that so often, but I just picture Spock in his quarters every night with his harp. He's like a singer-songwriter from the 23rd century, Vulcan singer-songwriter.
Well, in a muck time when he's sulking because he's ponfaring, there's this scene where he's in his quarters sulking, and I like to think that he plays his like Vulcan lute and like emos it up real hardcore in there.
I'm pretty sure.
That's what I think he does.
He's like space Alanis Morissette.
Exactly. Fallout Boy. He's got the hairstyle for it, I'm just saying.
He does, actually. Yeah.
Some people call me a space cowboy. Some people call me the Vulcan of love.
That was the one thing when I was a kid that the singing, it was, I don't know, I have this thing like if I have friends who are in bands and stuff like that, and I'm not sure what it is, probably because I would feel embarrassed if I was the one up there singing, but I feel embarrassed for them for no reason because they are totally fine and enjoying it. I watched that and I was just like, oh, Leonard Nimoy. Oh, no. Okay. I just like, la, la, la. It's wait till it's over. So for me, I've always had a weird association with the actors trying to sing on the show or do something musical, even if they have fantastic voices.
But like William Shatner, Leonard Nimoy did release albums after Star Trek. Yeah. So.
Yes, he did.
And then there was me with, like, my face basically being the personification of the heart eyes emoji, just like, yes, please. More.
Oh, man, that needs to be the artwork for this episode. It's like Andy with the heart
the
eyes.
The hearts. Spock.
Is that the next t-shirt that I'm making?
Sing to me, please.
So I have a feeling that if you had been assigned to the Enterprise, you and Nurse Chapel would not have been buddies. There would have been some rivalry going on.
I would have been fine with Nurse Chapel. It's just, what I don't get about Nurse Chapel is, like, move on. I'm sorry. Spock is not into you. Spock is never going to be into you. Like, you're a beautiful, talented, wonderful, sweet woman who makes great plomeek soup. Like, you can find a dude. You just you gotta move on. Spock's not for you. Spock's not for me either. I accept that. I would not have gotten the chance to hook up with Spock. I can just admire him from afar, like a normal person. Facebook stalk him, you know.
You're gonna Facebook stalk Spock.
And I think that was a conversation on some other episode that is there actually a space Facebook? Because it doesn't seem like there really is. Nobody connects. I might have been.
But there have been those great images that someone actually did a video about 4 or 5 years ago. I'm sure it's still on YouTube. That when Spock is staring into his science viewer, he's actually using space Facebook.
Nice.
And I guess then he finds out that Nurse Chapel or Andy is a Facebook Spock stalker.
Yep, that's me. I'm proud of it.
You're a card-carrying Spock stalker.
Yep.
All right. Well, we are closing in on an hour here, so why don't we just touch on any final thoughts that we have about the episode, about the healthy release of emotions, or anything else that maybe we would like to have seen picked up from this.
There's just one random comment that it's like, because they're supposed to be from the Greek culture, and then they randomly throw out piece de resistance, and I'm like, oh, okay, I'm not quite sure where that came from. Obviously, it's a
French
translation.
When you think that maybe Parman is actually Q, right?
Yeah. And so is the fruit filled with midichlorians? Is that how that works? Is that?
Yeah, the science in this episode makes zero sense, but I'm okay with it. Like, it's not, I don't care that it doesn't make sense, so I let it slide, man.
We need Sue's science corner.
We do, we need Sue.
Yeah, I don't think that the science of Spock's brain makes much sense either, that Spock can perform his own brain surgery.
You're definitely right about that.
Well, I did my own heart transplant. What are you talking about? Oh, no.
Well, you guys just stay tuned to my book that I'm working on, The Science of ALF. Now, that's where some science really doesn't make sense.
A world that lives on cats. ALF would go insane now with all of it. It would just be like Instagram pictures of food everywhere on the internet for him.
That's true. Yeah. Yes.
Like, now
YouTube would be like a gigantic video menu for ALF. That's true.
Yes.
I never thought about that, but you're right. So, Aaron, any other final thoughts? And do you have a rating for this one?
I would give it probably 4 out of 5 Shields of Pericles. That would be my ratings for this. I
have to say that I think it's amazing, amazing that Parman's like, I'm taking McCoy, have this random thing I have on my wall. That's a totally fair trade. Okay, yeah. Bye. Go back to your ship now. This transition is closed and completely fair. So off you go. I think that's one of the funniest things that has ever happened on the original series.
Well, Picard might actually like some of those, you know, archaeological finds.
It is kind of like a completely random thing that Kirk doesn't need, right? It's like, mm-hmm. I'm going to keep McCoy.
Like, seriously?
Please accept this Apple IIe signed by Steve Jobs and Steve Wozniak. Here you go. Right? It's like, Kirk's like, what am I going to do with this?
Kirk's already thinking about who he's going to re-gift that to.
Yeah. It's something that Picard would eventually inherit somehow, I think.
Yeah, and it would be on the wall in Picard's quarters forever. Yes. Yeah. All right. So, Andy, how about you? Any final thoughts and a rating?
Okay. So, I like this episode. but I don't love it. I think the themes of power are interesting, but as I said, I think the pacing is very odd, and I think a lot of the scenes are actually extremely hard to watch and uncomfortable. So the end, I'm going to give it 3 Spock serenades out of 5.
Excellent. And Mike?
Well, again, I really enjoyed the episode, so I'm going to give this one double Kieranite injections for everyone. I have to say, we were talking on the other side of the room.
The other side of the room.
The question was, will Parman change? Parman says to Kirk near the end of the episode, uncontrolled power will turn even saints into savages, and we can all be counted upon to live down to our lowest impulses. I think absolute power does corrupt absolutely, and I really don't think there's any hope for Parman. I think possibly he is Q. I'm not sure. Maybe that would make an interesting piece of fanfic there, but I don't think there's any hope for Parman. But I'm really gratified at the end of the episode that Kirk was able to make good on his promise to rescue Alexander from that. And again, I think Alexander makes the episode. So again, double Kieranite injections for everyone.
Well, my final thoughts on this episode are also that it's a story with a really good message. It highlights a goal that we've yet to achieve almost 50 years later, which is kind of sad. And hopefully we'll eventually get there, but sometimes I wonder. But it's something that we should certainly strive for. The episode itself, as you said, Andy, a lot of the things go on too long. Some of the scenes are uncomfortable to watch. It stands out as one of those third season episodes for me where they're just trying to put a story together. They're trying to put something on screen and they don't have the resources that they need. I do think that they could have done more in terms of writing dialogue that would not have cost money to shoot these scenes beyond what they're already doing, but would have made the episode a lot better. But I think some of that is a difference between storytelling that we expect now and storytelling that they were doing in the 1960s, certainly for a science fiction show like this. So I'm not in love with the episode, but I have sort of those fond memories of watching it when I was younger. I'm going to give it 5 giant chess pieces. All right. Well, thank you for joining us today, guys. Before you go, Andy, tell everyone where they can find you around the network and around social media and wherever you may be.
The easiest place to find me is on Twitter at First Time Trek, where I'm live tuning my first time through Star Trek. And I am currently on DS9 about to watch The Defiant. And You can also catch me as one of the hosts of Women at Warp right here on the network.
By the way, Andy, Defiant, you're going to love that episode.
Oh, am I? It's good to know.
It's always nice to know what you're going to like ahead of time. So
you set your
expectations.
It kind of takes the mystery out of it, but it's still good to know.
All right. And Mike, how about you?
I'm most active on Facebook. You can also find me on Twitter. My Twitter handle is at cmichael1701. I'm also on Instagram, cmichael1701. And I am co-host of Metatrex, along with my esteemed co-host, Zachary Frueling, who, again, thank you, Zachary, for giving up the cot. You can have it back. I'm done with it.
All right. Well, thanks again for joining us, guys.
Thank you.
Well, Aaron, that was an interesting discussion, and I have to say that Plato's stepchildren was a little bit more difficult to discuss than I was anticipating. And the reason I say that is just that in a lot of Star Trek episodes, we have 4 or 5 big topics that we hit on, but this one, it was sort of like, as we talked about with the pacing, you know, there was like a couple of things that just went on for a long time.
It also was a little bit like a stage play in some ways, where it had
very much,
you know, you've got that sort of one idea. So, yeah, it didn't have a breadth of conversation in that sense, but it was very interesting.
But I think we touched on the aspects of the story that really still apply today. And for me, it's always amazing when we have these stories. Well, it's not amazing because it's Star Trek and I expect it. But the fact that something could be written nearly 50 years ago and then we watch it today and we're like, you know, really good message here. Everyone needs to listen to this because we're still struggling with this.
Definitely.
So I'm glad we had a chance to talk about it, but it's not the only thing we've been talking about on the network recently, so here's a quick look at some of our other discussions.
Previously on Trek.fm, The Ready Room.
50 years, there's been something to carry it this far. In that vein of, hey, it's our generation or our era's mythic heroes that we can look up to. Do we dare put that in something that's lasted as long as, you know, literary-wise, Shakespeare and some of the other myths of you know, the ancients that have found a purpose and a use that still speak to people?
Women at Warp.
Admiral Alan Alda came to visit Captain Coretta Scott King. Meanwhile, morale officer Beyonce is trying to deal with her new Weasley sweater. And
they're all partying at the First Contact party.
Stage 9, a podcast about the people who make Star Trek.
I'm going to take a moment just to say Stage 9 here on the Trek FM network is the only show I'm aware of where you're going to hear somebody get this upset about camera technology.
And that's what else is happening on Trek.fm.
So check out all of these shows and find out what else we're talking about in your favorite corner of the Star Trek universe. You can find our shows everywhere you get your podcasts. We are a featured content provider with Apple and iTunes. We have an artist section there in the store that you can get to by going to iTunes.com/TrekFM. iTunes.com/TrekFM. That'll take you right over where you can see every single show we have, including the master feed. You can stream episodes from there. You can subscribe. Subscribing really helps us a lot. That helps us move up in the rankings so that people can find the shows when they're searching for Star Trek podcasts. And you can also leave a star rating and a written review, which we would really appreciate. Now, if you're not an iTunes user, you can, of course, find our shows in many other places. We are on TuneIn, Stitcher, Windows Phone, BlackBerry, SoundCloud. We're also on Google Play Music now, which is a wonderful thing for our Android listeners. Just check in your Google Play Music app, search for Trek FM, search for The Ready Room or our other shows, and they should come up for you there. You can also find The Ready Room on Spotify if you happen to be streaming this from the website. If you're not usually a podcast listener, you can listen to it there on Spotify. And you can always go to the website and stream or download the MP3 file from the show page there at trek.fm. If you want to leave feedback on today's show, we would love to hear your thoughts on Plato's Stepchildren or Star Trek Beyond. There are many ways for you to get in touch with us. You can go to Twitter, where our username is TrekFM. That's also our username pretty much everywhere. So on Facebook, our main page is facebook.com/TrekFM. You can go to the website, trek.fm/contact, and use the form that you find there. Choose to send to a show and choose The Ready Room, and that'll come to me by email. You can also leave a voicemail at speakpipe.com/TrekFM, the word speak, the word pipe together, .com/TrekFM. You can record that just using the mic on your phone, tablet, or computer and upload it right there from the page. And then if you want to have a bigger discussion, not only with hosts, but with fellow listeners, the place to do that is on Facebook in the Babel Conference, our closed listeners group. Aaron, tell everyone a little bit about the Babel Conference.
The Babel Conference is kind of the place where you go and you can have really respectful conversations. We've started a new thread that we basically have our refrigerator where you put all your pictures up. So we've got people.
Yes, that's right. Yeah.
Yeah. So we have people sharing sharing their memes and little things that wouldn't necessarily be like the best post all by itself.
Yeah. The refrigerator is a nice place to just pin stuff up. Absolutely. And then we have other threads where, like, when we post our shows, they go out to Facebook and we put that thread into the Babel Conference, and then discussion about that particular episode of The Ready Room or Saturday Morning Trek or To the Journey or whatever it may be happens in the thread that's attached to that post. So it's a great place to go and talk to fellow listeners and just extend the conversation beyond the podcast itself to the greater community, because that's very important to us. We don't want you to simply listen to the podcast and then be done. We want it to be a conversation starter. And so the Babel Conference is the place for you to go for that.
And I think if it wasn't for that, very few of us would be here, because we, you know, it's like, that's where we actually first have our interactions with hosts, and then like, oh, this is something I really enjoy. And you know, then I want to actually be a patron, and now I'm on the round table, and hey, now I have my own show. You know, that's not the same arc for everybody, but yes, exactly.
Yeah, exactly. That has happened for quite a lot of people over the past couple of years, for sure. So check that out. The way you get there on Facebook is to type Babel, B-A-B-E-L, into the search field, and it should come up. It is a closed group, so you need to click join, and then we'll let you in. We do check to make sure that you're actually a person and not some kind of spammer robot thing, because that's been happening more and more on Facebook recently.
And to many groups, not just ours, unfortunately.
Yeah, not just to ours. In fact, ours is probably less affected than most because
it seems like it, yeah.
Kind of a hidden group, but that's just a problem on Facebook in general. And so we do have you click join, but we'll let you on in. You can also get there by clicking discussion or discuss this episode on our website, either on the menu bar or in the links that appear alongside the artwork in the streaming player on the show pages. But Aaron, if people want to talk to you in general besides the Babel conference and find out what else you have going on, or if they want to listen to you talk about A-Rex and Mares, where should they go for that?
You can find me on Twitter at GeekFilter. That's my username. And I've been spending more time there than I had in the past. And you can occasionally find me writing information on TrekMovie.com, which is something we've been kind of mutually sharing content back and forth a little bit. So that's kind of fun. And I am the co-host of Saturday Morning Trek, our dedicated animated series podcast about Star Trek, the animated series, and all things Trek in the 1970s. So it's not just the animated series. We're talking about the rise of convention cultures. That's an episode coming up. We spoke with Dorothy Fontana, who's sort of, you know, Trek royalty at this point. We talked about her time on the animated series and other shows, other genre shows in the 70s, which was kind of fun. So yeah, so that's where you can find me. And we have a new co-host, Adam Drazen. He is stepping in and helping out. So we're very happy to have him.
Excellent. And of course, you are also the art director for the network, creator of many beautiful t-shirts and fun t-shirts, which are available in our store. So everyone go to trekfm.store. That's the URL, trekfm.store. That'll take you over there and you can see all of Aaron's amazing artwork and you can buy it on shirts or stickers or anything that you like. Many, many products. We've even seen photos of it on pillows recently, which
were
really
cool. Yeah, that was pretty fun. I was like, it's every once in a while, it's surprising. I'll just be scrolling through and suddenly like, hey, I made that. That's it's a very, very odd feeling.
Yeah, those pillows were really cool, and those were from Greg Rosier, a longtime listener of the network, who shared two different pillow designs that he has ordered at trekfm.store. And when you purchase stuff there, most of the money goes into the cost of actually producing the items, but the little bit that we do get from that helps us cover the costs of running the network, you know, production and distribution.
And we've sold quite a bit so far, it seems like. I went in there and looked the other day and I was like, oh, wow. Okay.
So. Yeah, we have sold quite a lot since we launched that. It's really wonderful. So that's one way to support us. Another way to support us is through Patreon at patreon.com/trekfm, patreon.com/trekfm. And it does cost quite a lot of money to operate this network. And we do need your support. We're listener supported. We do have a little bit of support at the moment here on this one show from Eagle Moss, which we greatly appreciate. But for the most part, we are a listener supported network. And without your help, we really cannot do this. So please go over and find out how you can support us there. Find out about the perks that we have for you. The special website Patron Zone, which is available only to patrons. And we really appreciate all the support that everyone gives us there. I'd especially like to thank our associate producers here on The Ready Room who support us through Patreon. Renee Roberts, Zachary Fruling, Sam Piasek, Kay Elizabeth Janeway, and Tim Robertson. If not for their support, I would not be able to do this show. So thank you so much, Renee, Zachary, Sam, Kay, and Tim. I really appreciate everything that you do for The Ready Room and for the network. And I do hope that others will go check it out and become part of the family at patreon.com/TrekFM. All right. So we know where to find Aaron. If you want to find me elsewhere on the network, I do The Orb with Matthew Rushing. That show is all about Deep Space Nine. I also do Hyper Channel, our short news show from time to time, and I edit Warp 5 behind the scenes. So go check out Warp 5 if you are an Enterprise fan. And I also publish From There to Here every day for everybody. I don't know how many people know that I'm doing that. That is a massive collaborative team effort amongst all the 35 to 40 people who work behind the scenes and on mic here at Trek FM. And my little part of it, because I'm not around in my studio when I need to be in order to record episodes with people for From There to Here, My part of it is publishing the episodes while I'm riding the train to work. So I do that every day. I hope everyone's enjoying our rewatch of the entire Star Trek franchise for the 50th anniversary. And then if you want to find my writing about Star Trek, you can find that over on the official website at StarTrek.com. Just search for my name, C. Brian Jones. That's Brian with a Y, and articles should come up. C. Brian Jones is my username on Twitter, Facebook, pretty much everywhere in social media as well, if you want to find me over there. Also, before we go, I would like to thank once again our sponsor, Eagle Moss, and the official Star Trek Starships collection. This is the ultimate collection officially authorized by CBS Studios. You can get beautiful starships from 50 years of Star Trek, all the series, all the movies, all expertly sculpted, hand-painted. They come with the collector's magazine that we talked about, the beautiful stands as well. And there's so much variety. It's really amazing. I want to invite you to start your collection today. You can get the USS Enterprise 1701D for just $4.95 with free shipping. Head over to the special URL, st-starships.com/readyroom, to get full details about the collection. Look at the starships. Start your subscription. Place your order. You'll get two new ships every month delivered right to your door. They're really, really wonderful. I have a lot of them right here around me as I'm recording, and I really encourage you to go check them out. And it's a great way to support the show and the network all at the same time. Again, the URL is st-starships.com/readyroom, and we really thank Eagle Moss so much for their support of the show. All right, Aaron, well, I am, against my better judgment, going to beam back down to visit the Plutonians because I just want to know what other kind of odds and ends they have to give away as gifts.
Maybe when you're down there, you can pick me up some Plutonian animation. Maybe they have some of that. That would be interesting.
I bet it's kind of sadistic.
Yeah, it might be. Well, it's time to stick a shard of pottery in it, because the Ready Room is done.
Recording.
All right. Telepathic fruit pants. I don't know what those are.
Well, we're with the Plutonians, so there are no pants.
Yeah,
just
they're,
saying.
They're
oh, that's true.
Togas.
Yeah, that is true. I like the fact that when Uhura and Chapel beam down, after they beam down and they've got on the dresses and they come in the room and then Kirk and Spock come in, they don't think there's anything odd about the way they're dressed.
Yeah.
The way Kirk and Spock are dressed. There's no like, Captain, what are you wearing or anything? It's just, this is perfectly normal.
Well, weren't
Mr.
they?
Mr. Spock, I believe you forgot your pants.
Weren't they put into a different outfit at that point?
Yeah, they were, but you know, they were wearing kind of like elegant long dresses.
Well, but I would assume that they would have thought then that the native Plutonians, what am I saying? The
Plutonians.
Plutonians, sorry, yes. Probably, you know, changed their outfits. I'm assuming they would have put two and two together.
I guess.
I hope. I mean, it was like, oh, I didn't know you had that outfit.
Yeah, right. You've been hiding that in your quarters, yeah. Spock. I never see you roaming the corridors with that. And it would be corridors because, as we established on last week's Ready Room, starship design in the future is basically just a series of corridors. Right.
In my headcanon in Star Trek The Motion Picture, Spock is unpacking when he comes aboard the Enterprise, and he actually pulls that outfit out of his suitcase.
Hangs it up so it won't get wrinkled. Yeah. Then in The Undiscovered Country, when Valeris comes in his quarters, that's what's hanging on the wall.
That would have been awesome.
That is fun.
Okay, I'll lead us in with the intro.